But one way you will understand it too, in these words that I say, I'll close my eyes to everyone but you. I'll see you standing there . I'll lock my heart to any other caress . I'll never say yes to a new love affair. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart. Don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, California. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we're available to you 7 days a week, 24 hours a day via podcast. You can find us at iTunes, or you can visit us at penonfire.com. Just click on the radio tower on the left-hand side of your screen, and that will lead you to our radio page. From there, you can view upcoming guests, see who's been on in the past, and access podcasts from our past shows by clicking on the archives. This will join almost, I don't know, well over 200 other interviews up and available to you now. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara this day after Christmas. She'll be back with you next week. As always, Writers on Writing features live conversations with authors, poets, agents, editors, publishers, all those good folks who keep books on our shelves and in our lives. This morning, I'm joined by Harry Mount, and stay with me for our second half hour when I'll be joined by Michael Fitzgerald, author of Radiant Days. Harry Mount read classics at Oxford and was a Latin tutor before becoming a journalist. He's been an editorial writer, and New York correspondent at the Daily Telegraph. His latest book, Carpe Diem, Put a Little Latin in Your Life, published by Hyperion, is the focus of our discussion this morning. Harry, welcome.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, thanks for coming on this day after Christmas.
Exactly. No, I hope you had a good one.
Good. So before we get too far in, tell us first how you came to be so entranced by Latin and how the book came to be about.
Sure. Well, I suppose I had a pretty traditional, old-fashioned English education, and I went to a traditional English prep school here in London, where I'm calling you from, and I started learning Latin at the age of 9 and Greek at the age of 11, and then I did it all the way through to university at Oxford, and loved it enormously. And then I once wrote an article, now a couple of years ago, about how important it was to learn Latin, and my publishers suggested that I do a book on it. and there was only an original print run of 4,000 over here in Britain, and in the end it's sold to date, 100,000 has just come out in the States a month ago, and hopefully it'll do well there too. But I think it shows this tremendous fashion for old-fashioned things not being useless, but very, very useful and beautiful at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Now, is it typical for... it wasn't typical. I think we're roughly the same age, and it was not typical here in the United States to study Latin when I was a kid. How typical is it in London to study the classics still?
It's not typical at all, and in fact, just like in the States, there was a great collapse in the study of Latin and Greek in the early 60s, and it having been a fairly standard subject in many schools across Britain, and many more in America as well, there was a tremendous collapse in the early 60s, and there's been a small revival the last 4 or 5 years, both here and in the States. Figures studying Latin have roughly doubled in high school, both here in America, but from a very in the last 5 years, but from a very low base.
Mm-hmm. And the book went through a name change from Britain to the U.S. In Britain, it was known as Amoa Mas Amats and all that.
Exactly.
How to become a Latin lover. Can you talk about the need for the new name in the U.S.?
Sure. What happened was when it came out over here under that name, Amoa Mas Amat, and all that, how to become a Latin lover. And your listeners will probably know that Amo means I love. So that was the link for how to become a Latin lover. It was sent out to a journalist over here for publicity reasons. And the journalist, before she'd read it, emailed my publisher and said, how fantastic, a book of Latin sex tips. and she said, no, it's not that. And so... thought there might be a confusion over in the States along the same lines, so it was given this more familiar name of Carpe Diem, which I think is particularly familiar from the movie Dead Poets Society.
Yeah.
But actually, funny enough, there's a good postscript to that the girl who said this was a friend of the publisher. She's now just written a book, which is a book of Latin sex tips, so it did have a tale story to it.
Did she call it by your title?
No, she didn't. She called it, I can't remember, actually. But anyway, so I thought for those two reasons, Carpe Diem was more familiar, and also not to confuse the reader.
Yeah, it's perfect. It's perfect. I'm afraid you're talking to, a typical American who didn't study Latin in school.
Oh, sure, no problem. Yeah.
and who nothing of it before this book, and now I just appreciate how difficult it is to learn it. Although the book was a great, easy guide in.
Oh, good, thanks.
So what's the, talk about the importance of learning and studying and picking apart a dead language. It seems with the conjugations and the frightening words with the ablatives and the declensions seemed like the intimidating part. Is that what makes it so difficult to learn?
I think part of the reason is because it's so very different to English. A lot of people say the reason why you should learn Latin is because it's similar to English, and of course there are great similarities. But at the same time, I think the reason why it's difficult, but also why it's so useful, is because it's so different. So things like the ablative, as you say, or even more obscure grammatical constructs like the ablative absolute or the gerundive don't have any equivalents in English. And funnily enough, it's when translating from Latin into English and having to completely change not only the words but the grammatical constructions that you really work out how not just English and Latin but how all languages are constructed. And once you know those things inside out, it becomes much easier to write in a easy flowing way because you know the rules so well. Like being a great football player, the more adept you are with your tools, the more skillfully and free-flowingly you can use your language. And so I'm not going to say it's an easy ride, although, as you kindly said, my book is supposed to be a kind, gentle introduction to it. But once you know these difficult things, then the English language becomes a breeze.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was interesting that early on in the book you said the only reason you will know English better as a result of reading Latin is because it's so different from Latin, not because of the similarities.
Exactly, yeah. And the same applies for the meanings of words. Often, of course, there are tremendous similarities between Latin words and English ones, but it's often in the difference that you learn about the journey of a word, and actually it can be incredibly enjoyable. An example I give in the book is the word candid, which comes from candidus aurum, meaning white, pure, unvarnished, and you can see the connection with our word candid. But the connection is not so obvious with our word candidate. It's been a long time since I've heard the word candidate in the same sentence as white, pure, unvarnished, particularly in a political context. But it's only when you discover that Roman candidates to become senator would sprinkle themselves with white chalk dust in order to be to stand out in a crowd when they were standing for election. So they became known as the candidus one, the candid one, thus the candidate. So that's a big jump, but I find it incredibly enjoyable working out these journeys of particular words.
Yeah, and that was the real great, there are many great strengths of this book. The kind and gentle introduction to Latin was one, but also rediscovering or learning the origins of so many things that I didn't know about. That was great. It was great. And I want to talk a lot about more of those.
Sure.
How different do you think it is to study Latin versus any of the other Latin-based languages?
It's more difficult, I think, precisely because, as you say, it's a dead language. So there is no wriggle room in moving from one language to the other. If you're translating from English to French, you can use what's called franglais, which is sort of a mixture of the two languages to get along. And, of course, French borrows a lot of English words. And I've just been in Germany where the book came out, and I discovered there's a similar halfway house language called Denglish, which is a mixture of Deutsch and English. And because there isn't that wriggle room in Latin, again, it is tricky because it's dead. You can't start inventing new words in a dead language. But actually, again, like I was saying early on about there being different grammatical constructions, it makes for a tremendous crunching of the cogs of the brain to be trained like that. You know, there's no room for gray area. You've got to get it right or you're wrong. And that makes for a very, very precise language when you're going from English into Latin. Funnily enough, going the other way, from Latin to English, you then sharpen your imagination because Latin is this very concise, precise language. And in translating from Latin to English, you've got to expand the words, and there's tremendous room for interpretation. So I like to use this analogy of like a squeeze box, and that when you go from English to Latin, it's like pushing the squeeze box closed. You've got to be precise and concise, and then when you go the other way from Latin to English, you're opening up the squeeze box, and you can be tremendously imaginative in your different interpretations.
Great analogy. That's a great analogy. You know, this might be a good time for you to read to us, and then that can take us further into the book and discussing more of the great things you talk about. Can
sure.
You,
well, if your readers won't mind, it's a lighthearted bit about the origins of the Toga Party, which when I was in the States, as you said in your introduction, I was in New York for a couple of years, and I travel around the States a lot, and a lot of university students were amazed that we didn't have them over here, and so I've been looking into the origins of the Toga Party, and here we are from the book.
Excellent.
The origins of the Toga Party are lost in the alcoholic mists of time. It appears that the parties began in the early years of the 20th century as a natural offshoot from fraternity's Greek roots. In the early 1930s, Eleanor Roosevelt held a toga party at the White House to tease the journalists and politicians who had conceived of her husband as a second Caesar. But toga parties really only took off after the launch of the movie Animal House in 1978. The party in the movie was inspired by the memories of one of the film's writers, Harold Ramis, who had been a member of the Zeta Beta Tau fraternity at Washington University in St. Louis. The film's toga party scene is crucial to the plot. The Deltas, the worst frat at Faber College in 1962, as opposed to the best, the Omegas, are on double secret probation because the college dean hates them so much. Thinking that things can't get much worse, they decide to at least have the ultimate good time before they're disbanded. And I'm sure your listeners will have heard the plot of Animal House, so I won't go on from that. But then I'll continue with the history. And shortly after the movie came out, Newsweek did a feature on the toga party, and universities went crazy for the idea, emulating John Belushi and his fellow Deltas. 10,000 University of Wisconsin students dressed themselves in bedsheets and laurel wreaths for a huge party in late 1978. Belushi and several of the other actors from the movie took to turning up unannounced at campus parties. By the time of the publication of the official Preppy Handbook in 1980, only 2 years later, toga parties had become an acknowledged part of university life. The handbook gives this stern advice. Toga party. Girls wear designer sheets, men wear the kind from the linen service. If accompanied by a Roman-style dinner, these sheets may go home stained with red wine, though serious drinkers might switch to a grain alcohol punch around 10 o'clock. Since dancing in a toga is impossible, getting drunk is the primary activity. And I promise you, there are a lot of good stuff about the actual Latin language in the book as well, but I thought that was a lighthearted way into it.
That's perfect. That was Harry Mount reading from his latest book, Carpe Diem, Put a Little Latin in Your Life, available now and published by Hyperion. Yeah, that is great. And that really was part of the allure of this book was when the going got tough, then we got to take a neat aside and frolic and detour into some great background in history. And I'm curious how you set about defining the universe of what the book would include, because it includes a lot of things, you know, architecture and Roman emperors and obviously an introduction to Latin, all in 250 pages, which is, you know, accessible. How did you wrap your arms around what would make it into the book and perhaps what wouldn't?
Well, I thought to a great extent, first of all, about how it appears in popular culture, both Latin and Roman inventions. And so things like Animal House seemed obvious. There's a terrific scene in Monty Python's The Life of Brian where a Roman centurion takes a Christian slave to task for the graffiti of his Latin being wrong. And so those seemed obvious elements to go into it. I then thought, again, how actual bits of Latin turn up all over the place and people use them without knowing what they mean. I always find that people are very, very interested to find exactly what these words mean that they use the whole time. So there are thousands of examples, and there's a list of them in the book, but a classic is RIP, which we put obviously after people's names when they've died, and people think it means rest in peace, which it certainly does, but the original meaning was what they had put in Roman tombstones, which is requiescat in pace, which means not just rest in peace, but may he rest in peace. It's got the element of using the subjunctive, which is a particular way of implying obligation. And there are endless examples like that. Re, meaning concerning, is actually from res, rei, feminine, meaning thing or matter. So it literally means in the matter of. And so I went into individual words, and then I also thought about how it's at the basis of our language, thus, as I was talking about, candidate, and also how incredibly important it is to literature, in that the Greeks and the Romans, between them, basically sewed up Western European and American literature, where it came up with tragedy, comedy, poetry, great historians, and in fact, the Greeks did most of that. The Romans admitted, the satirist Quintilian admitted that the Greeks had done most of the great literary inventions, and he said, the one thing we Romans have got is satire. But between them, they basically covered the waterfront. And so those are the main things, just the words, the language, the architecture, and the literature.
Yeah, and the literature part was fascinating to me, and it gave me an appreciation for, you know, you probably can become a better writer if you know how your language works and the roots of it. And I'm curious as to, now you've obviously studied Latin your entire life, but I'm curious how maybe in other people you've seen Latin and knowing Latin, how it may have changed their writing or how you think it might impact your own writing.
Oh, definitely. I was struck. I used to work for the Daily Telegraph, not only in New York, but back in London on the op-ed page there, and you'd often get very bright kids in their late teens, early 20s, coming in to do internships, and quite often they're very bright, but they had very bad grammar, and the real test was they very, very regularly got what we call over here the grocer's apostrophe. I don't know if you have the same expression, which is the way we describe when a greengrocer on his fruit and vegetable stalls puts, you know, pound of tomatoes a dollar and puts the apostrophe in the wrong place, which is a big bugbear over here, and it's become known as the grocer's apostrophe. And I noticed that any of these kids, if they'd ever done any Latin, they never got the grocer's apostrophe wrong, because as I was saying earlier on, once you've worked out this crunchy change from Latin into English and vice versa, there's a Latin expression, you know, you get a sort of bird's eye view of the language, you know exactly why that apostrophe is there, and so you just won't get it wrong in the same way that you won't hit a tennis shot out on purpose because you know the rules. And so I feel that very, very strongly, that those who know Latin know English grammar. And then one step further, it doesn't mean that they're then very, very precise and constipated in their English. It often means that, as I said, they're very, very free-flowing because they know the rules. They got the confidence to be colloquial.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. I'll remind our listeners that you're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine, and I'm here with Harry Mount, author of Carpe Diem, Put a Little Latin in Your Life. I read an article where you said something very interesting and very, I think, true, and you mentioned at the beginning of this interview essentially the idea that people are more and more concerned with holding on to old things.
Yeah.
Perhaps there's a sort of a nostalgia, and perhaps technology and text messaging and email are moving us farther and farther away from the beauty of our own language. Do you attribute that to the success of this book and books like Eat Shoots and Leaves and maybe the resurgence of Latin?
I think it's chicken and egg. I'm not sure which came first, the resurgence of interest in old traditional academic subjects or which then produced the books, or vice versa. I do think what's true is that both in Britain and the States, we made the mistake of thinking things were useless because they were old and we could do without them, so they were pretty much thrown out of most schools, both in the States and over here. And then there's been a realization the last couple of years that that we were wrong, and that actually there's a reason why these things had survived so long until the 60s, was because not only were they very useful, as I've been saying, for studying language, but they're also very beautiful, moving subjects in their own right. So I think people like me and Lynn Truss, who wrote Eat Shoots and Leaves, are very lucky, because if we'd written our books in 1955, no one would have bought them, because they would have been standard issue. You know, most people would have known this stuff and they'd have been taught in school. So I think people have a desire for these old-fashioned things, partly because of being nostalgic, but also because they see how useful they are. And in fact, I came across a terrific line in, I don't know how familiar your listeners are with the British poet Philip Larkin, but he wrote a terrific poem called Church Going, about going to visit a church, and he wasn't a believer, and he wasn't interested in church architecture, but he said he was still very moved on visiting a church, and he came up with this brilliant line, which I'll read out, which goes, "Someone will forever be surprising a hunger in himself to be more serious." And I think he's spot on, and that explains the revival as well, and that in this sea of trivia that we get on the TV and in the newspapers, that underneath all that, there still is this hunger to be more serious.
Yeah, but beautifully put.
Thanks.
On a completely selfish note, I really enjoyed the section on the Vestal Virgins that I had no idea of their history, and I thought maybe you could share that with us too.
Oh, sure. Well, for anyone who's who's unmarried in their mid-30s, and I speak as one of those people myself, there's hope for us all that the Vestal Virgins, the famous group of virgins who looked after the Temple of Vesta in Rome, tended to remain virgins and tended to remain in the temple for 20 or 30 years from a very young age, and then once they had left the temple, then they were considered very, very good marriage prospects in their mid-30s. So they were at least 33 when they left the temple, and they were considered an excellent catch, so that there's hope for us all. But they did have these... they were considered very, very holy figures, and their main job was to maintain the sacred fire of Vesta, who is the goddess of the hearth. And I don't know if you have these matches called Swan Vestas that we have over here, but they're named after the Vestal Virgins because they're matches that wouldn't go out easily because of this eternal flame was kept going in the Temple of Vesta. And so the virgins would start at a very young age, from 3 to 10, and were considered very, very important citizens. And they had special privileges. They could look after their own property, which wasn't allowed for other women in Rome. They had special seats at the games in the Colosseum, while all the other women had to sit in the back row. And they were generally sacred. But in return, they had some pretty tough rules, mainly that they had to remain a virgin. And if they did break their vow of chastity, they were buried alive, which isn't great. The reason for that was because if you spilt a Vestal Virgin's blood, you yourself were slogged to death. So it was a fairly tricky quid pro quo. Then another bit of Latin is you had this sort of special status and you were considered a great catch once you left the temple, but you had a rough time if you broke the main rule.
That is great. That's great. Yeah, the beauty of this is you covered so very much territory, and like you say, it was a kind and gentle introduction to the language itself, but so much more. We're just about out of time, but I was wondering if
sure.
you could leave us with any last minute wisdom or advice for writers out there or for those who are thinking about embarking on Latin.
Well, I'd say that it's certainly difficult to get to the stage where you can read, say, Virgil completely through in the original, but it doesn't take much to get to a stage where you can translate small phrases. And one of my favorites from Virgil, which I'll finish on, is Olim haec meminisse etiam juvabit, which is what Aeneas hears from his best friend when he thinks his chances of founding Rome are destroyed because his fleet is wrecked on the coast of Italy, and his best friend Achates says this line, Olim haec meminisse etiam juvabit, saying, one day you'll laugh when you remember these things. And I remember reading that when I was about 13 or 14 and thinking that was great then, and it's even greater now. There are very few things in life which, however bad they seem now, aren't okay a year later or certainly 10 years later. And we may not end up founding Rome, but everything seems to turn out pretty good in the end. And like with so many things, the Romans got there first with these little bits of consolation. So a little bit of Latin goes a long way.
This is great. Harry, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Great pleasure. Happy New Year to you.
You too. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, and when we return, Michael Fitzgerald, author of Radiant Days, will be with me. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, Rome wasn't built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. And as I mentioned earlier, this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit penonfire.com for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett, taking you through the holiday. I'm joined now by Michael Fitzgerald. Michael has been the recipient of the Fish Trap Fellowship, an Idaho Commission on the Arts Literature Fellowship, and an ICA Quick Funds Grant. His shorter works can be found in Swink, Massachusetts Review, Cut Bank, Northwest Review, Other Voices, and Boise Weekly. Michael's first novel, Radiant Days, was released this year by Shoemaker and Horde, and we will talk about it this morning. Michael, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. And particularly this day after Christmas, I know you're in the middle of moving, and you have two little boys, so there's a lot on your plate, I know.
Yeah, busy week.
So let's delve into the book, which despite the title, was fantastically dark. Tell us about Radiant Days.
It's essentially kind of a treatment of, anyone who was 20 in the 90s and kind of, there was this, I felt that there was this, I think everyone who was part of the dot-com thing kind of could sense that it was, a hall of mirrors and that while you were in it, on the day-to-day basis, it was great. We were getting paid and whatnot. And then you'd go home and sit down and kind of try to think about what you actually did. And it didn't really add up. And I took that and I just tried to contrast that against something else that was going on in the world, which was the Balkan War. And that's essentially the backdrop of the story.
Mm. And how did the... So did the idea come to you through the door of the dot-com craze, or did it come to you through the Hungary, Croatia, Budapest door?
I lived in Eastern Europe right after college, and which was 93. And so I kind of had that background and I always wanted to be a writer, so I was writing when I was over there. But when I arrived back in the United States in 94 and then kind of like everyone fell into the dot-com stuff, that was when I just felt the tension between the two worlds, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And so the bulk of the novel takes place in Budapest and some in Croatia. And you said you spent, how much time did you spend over there?
I was mostly in Budapest for about a year and a half.
Okay. And I assume during that time you were taking notes and as a writer probably absorbing the landscape. But despite having spent some time over there, how difficult is it to set a novel in a place so foreign and once you're home and writing it, perhaps it feels kind of inaccessible to you?
Right. I mean, the internet has made a lot of that, torn down that wall a little bit. I mean, some of the things in the book are extremely foreign to me. Like there's a baby orphan or an orphan trading scheme also going on in the background, and which I don't have any real firsthand experience with. And I researched that, you know, I would get on chat groups and I would, you know, essentially just kind of troll around in listservs and stuff looking for, you know, how do you act, how do, I mean, that was happening. People in America were going to Romania and more or less buying children. And I kind of, the internet made that all accessible, which I don't think you would have had, you know, obviously 20 years ago. But while I was over there, I think like most people in a foreign culture, you're inside your head a lot more, and it makes writing much easier because you just can't talk out your day. And so I had tons of notes and whatnot still from that time, which I hadn't thrown out.
Yeah, it does seem like the best way to examine a culture, you know, maybe particularly the U.S., is to leave it and look back at it from a distance, and maybe to see a new culture with new eyes, is to, you know, kind of stand outside of it as an observer.
Yeah, you know, I mean, to that point, like, while I was over there, I had such a romanticized version of what I was living in, and then, you know, 10 years later, looking back at the notes and kind of, you know, just having some distance, it had a darker undertone to it, and I kind of like, I think the book pulled that out more than my notes. I was just like, this is great, you know, I mean, everything was cheap and beautiful, and, I mean, to me,
mm-hmm.
And then, you know, from a distance, it seemed like we were somehow exporting American culture at the cost of another, and also sort of taking advantage of the fact that this country had been abused for 50 years, and now we're young Americans were living extremely well because of it.
Right. And so as you were living there, did you have those observations about America? Was it harder to come back to the U.S. after that experience? And you know, did it kind of jade your view of the U.S.?
I don't think it jaded my review. I mean, it didn't. The most difficult thing about coming back to the U.S. was the severe drop in my lifestyle. Because, you know, we were all 22, 23 years old, and, you know, this was happening in Prague and throughout any of the countries that the wall had just fallen in. And we were right out of college, and we had no business living as well as we were. And, you know, simply because you could, you know, your currency was you could speak English. And so when I came back, I kind of, and I think this was true for most people who came back, they had this expectancy of, that they were going to come back and live a remotely similar lifestyle. And, you know, I came back and temped, you know, I had crappy temp jobs for about 5 years, and it was not remotely the same life.
I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here with Michael Fitzgerald, author of Radiant Days. One of the things that really struck me about this novel is that each of the characters is fairly significantly flawed. And they all make some, you know, kind of remarkably sort of raw and difficult to accept decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, you know, I liked that. I thought they were, you know, good people who I still rooted for. And I think what saved them for me was their authenticity and their flaws. And, you know, maybe I can relate to fundamentally flawed people. But I hope you could talk about what it's like to populate your fictive world with fairly kind of deeply flawed characters and nonetheless make the reader like them at least enough to, you know, to want to stay with them for the length of the novel.
Right. I mean, I think that my hope was that, I mean, Anthony, the narrator's flaws is essentially he's just hapless and young, and he kind of is without any tools to navigate the world, and his flaws are mostly neglect and So, I mean, I think we all have that in us, especially when we're young. I don't think he's too
mm-hmm.
off the norm for your average 23-year-old.
Right.
And then Marsh, who's kind of not quite the anecdote to Anthony, but he's a much smarter, you know, he's much more worldly, and he's much more educated. And he, you know, he's British, so he kind of speaks with a more confidence, and he's just a crisper character.
Mm-hmm.
But he also, more or less, when they're being boys together, they, you know, have locker room talk, and Marsh is essentially, you know, elitist and sexist in a kind of more interesting way than Anthony is. And then Gisela, who is the anecdote to both of them, who's really a real person who has the world. Both the guys kind of, part of their problem is they have no real problems.
Right.
And Gisela is actually a character who is on her heels and she skewers everything they both kind of, both their existence. Like, she's meant to be somebody who actually has to act, and her actions have real consequences in the world. And she's desperately trying, she has to eat and get shelter and stuff, as with these other two guys, kind of, those aren't concerns, more or less. And she's more of in cave person mode than, while they're both dilettantes.
Yeah.
But essentially, if you make them authentic, I think, if you're honest about them and you just have them, and we all do bad things, or we all make wrong decisions, then that hopefully you can keep your readers with you, because just by making them authentic and saying, well, this person exists, and yes, we all make wrong decisions, I guess.
Yeah, was it difficult as an American to form and create foreign characters? How difficult was it for you to get into, obviously didn't have to get into Gisela's head, because, it wasn't her point of view, but she was a very fully drawn out, fully realized character. How hard was it for you to create these foreign characters, particularly foreign women characters?
I kind of noticed that I hadn't done it. I hadn't really created her when I thought I was finished with the novel the first time, and I just kind of knew the other two characters. I mean, Anthony particularly, but Marsh is, he's a type, and when I wrote the first draft, I clearly leaned on them much more than I did her, and I just kind of forgot that I wasn't writing her. I didn't realize until I'd put it down for about 6 months that she wasn't there, and then. So I, had the job of kind of fleshing her out, and to this point, it's kind of one of those things that I think when we're first writing, we always lean on memory, and even now when I say, okay, I'm going to write a scene in a bathroom, I think of all the bathrooms I've ever been in, and I start pulling details out of that, and so then I get a bathroom, and then I say, but this doesn't serve the story, this is just the bathrooms that I know. And then you actually have to lean on your imagination. And with her, I was like, wow, I really have to make up a character. I can't lean on my memory for her. And I think in some ways, it's where I learned how to write, trying to write her.
Interesting. That's interesting. Perhaps you can read to us for a few minutes now and kind of take the listeners into your world, and then we can use that as a jumping point to talk about more about the book. I'm speaking with Michael Fitzgerald. He's author of Radiant Days, published by Shoemaker and Horde. And go ahead.
Okay. This is just an excerpt from the first chapter. And the opening scene takes place at a party of mostly expats. And Anthony, who has arrived in Budapest, he's traveling with Gisela, and they... at the end of the party, they're going home, and this is just them on the tram after leaving the party. On the tram home, an hour or so later, a warm rain had begun falling, and Gisela wouldn't look at me. She was staring out the window, holding the bar on the seat in front of us so tightly her knuckles were baby skin pink. "Why'd you tell that man about my son?" she asked. "He wanted to know what I was doing here," I said. Her eyes reflecting in the tram window, staring hard at nothing. Past her, the glass was blurry with spidery rivulets and drips. "It's none of his business," she said. "What am I supposed to tell people?" "Tell him we're in love. Tell him you love me. You followed me here. People will like that. People will think I'm a sap," I said. "What, Anthony, we aren't in love?" she asked. "Is there a Teen Vogue article that's required reading for every 15-year-old girl? Are they taken aside the moments their breasts start to bud and told, no man knows his heart, no man knows what he really wants or what he should say or do about anything having to do with love, even in jest? Just say it confidently, and you will always be in charge." I wasn't in love. I didn't know how I felt, but she was the most gorgeous woman I'd ever touched, and my heart was beating. I swallowed. I reached across her and put my hand against the drips on the window. She lifted her hand from the bar and placed it on my thigh. She smiled, waiting for me to calm. "My nice guy," she finally said. She stretched up and kissed my cheek, then hugged herself against my arm and whispered, "My body feels alone." The tram went along the inky black Danube. She eventually let go of my arm and pointed up at the lights on the top of the hill on the other side, Gellert and the Castle District. She pressed her finger against the window and drew a line in the condensation. "The tower on top of the hill used to be a monument," she said. "It was the last place to fall to the Nazis. I think it's a disco now run by the Mafia. And the castle's a mediocre art museum. They've got a few of Picasso's plates." The tram turned back into the city. Shops were closing. Salamis and shanks of prosciutto hung in deli windows like torpedoes. There was a statue in the middle of the traffic circle of a man holding a musket, looking vaguely like Lenin. The red awnings of the cafe patios were dark with drizzling rain. A wet billboard with women diving into an azure pool took up one whole side of the building. Another had waiters holding out platters of bursting, impossibly large foods. 4-century-old churches moped in the shadows of the newer skyscrapers. A McDonald's glowered from a building older than the United States. We passed a courthouse with a floodlight illuminating an embossed mural on its wall. The mural depicted healthy, square-jawed farmers and factory workers staring off into a radiant future. The men and women had shoulders and chests like superheroes and were surrounded by a bounty of wheat and grapes. The tram stopped and more people got off than on. Then it continued down the wide boulevard until it cut into City Park. There was an empty Ferris wheel, a cold-looking merry-go-round with shiny wet horses, and a boarded-up, green-roofed concession stand. Rain, like machine gun spray, fell on a small dark lake. "See that pond?" she asked. I nodded. It was home to a dozen swans until Romanians ate them. Thanks.
That was Michael Fitzgerald reading from his novel Radiant Days. That was great. You said in an interview something that I really connected with, and that was, my favorite writing is when we're pulled in two directions. I love when something has me laughing and then seconds later feeling awful, and that was my hope with the narrator, Anthony. I thought that was really interesting, and I hoped you could talk about that for just a couple of minutes of when you felt like you were being pulled in two different directions with him, and how difficult that sense was to create in the novel.
I guess, in the book, when I think it's working, really kind of the awful scene, you know, there's some sort of sexually depraved scenes, which are both horrific and comic. And the comic part is kind of is Anthony's haplessness, I think. We all, especially when we're younger, sort of fall into these scenarios or something just ridiculous, and while we're in it, we're like, this isn't happening. And it's horrifying to be in it, and then 2 seconds later, we're laughing, or the opposite. While we're in it, like, this is great, and then we actually think about what we're doing, and it's horrific. I guess when you're trying to write that, you know, there's just that fine edge of when it is just flat out mean, and when it's. I think you do it by. You just have to find where that thin line is, where a character really is being human but possibly being awful, and hope you write around that and hope something comes up.
Yeah, and those are always the interesting intersections. You know, when things are going smoothly, it rarely takes the reader's attention, and when things are uncomfortable and funny and uncomfortable, and even the reader at first, you know, finds themselves pulled into the scene and thinking it's funny, and then kind of having the same experience that Anthony had. Those are the interesting parts of the novel. Those are great.
Yeah, and it's like why we watch car accidents or anything. You know, we don't want to see it, but we just can't not look. And right, fiction or story comes out of people pressing against each other and the friction between ourselves and either other people, and that friction is generally awful. awkward stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And speaking of which, your work was nominated for Nerve.com's Henry Miller Award for the best literary sex scene published in the English language. And by the looks of it, you're doing very well. I think it's people are voting on it, and it's doing very well.
Yeah.
It's by far and away the most literary sex scene. And I know writing those, I know writing sex scenes is no easy feat. Your scenes are very edgy and uncomfortable, yet, fluid and unique and authentic. How do you approach these scenes, and how do you steer clear of the cliches and trappings of the normal, kind of bad scenes we always read and make things, kind of fresh and interesting?
Thanks. I don't know. I mean, I guess with sex or with anything, you just try to be as honest as possible. And if you're doing something, the more outlandish or the more extreme, and, if you have someone die, you just obviously have to write that scene 10 times harder than if you have someone walk into the next room, even though someone walking from one room into the other is really the hardest thing to write.
Mm-hmm.
You just owe it to whatever, if you're going to put sex on the page, which, with young people, it always is so, sex is such a just mess, I went to all boys Catholic school, and I was pretty, I guess I'm pretty familiar with sort of violence or frustration coming out of sex, or violence coming out of sexual frustration, and I think I naturally, when I was younger, had a Catholic uncomfortable view of sex, and I would try to plug into that uncomfortableness whenever I would write.
Yeah, it makes for a very edgy fiction. That's great.
Yeah. And I think one of my favorite books when I was little was Sun Also Rises, and I loved that, the unconsummation of things. I mean, that whole book is propelled by the fact that they don't consummate, or they can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in the draft of this book, I really latched onto that. And when I was originally writing, I was thinking, I'll just have a really sex, like a sex-filled book with no sex. that would just right. create momentum somehow. And the original draft, there was, and most of these scenes, they don't really connect. It's like unsex sex or something.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Interesting. Were there surprising things that came out of this novel for you, things that you didn't expect to have to touch on or deal with, but that you ultimately did, or some revelation that came out of it after you were finished with it?
I really thought that the book was, I meant for the book itself to be kind of the 13th chapter. I meant that, Anthony's this wannabe writer guy kind of flopping around, and at the end of the book he's kind of desolated, and he is just sitting there alone, and I won't go into it, but he's in an uncomfortable, awkward place, and a lot of the reviews have been upset that there isn't some sort of uplift or whatever.
Hmm.
And I was pretty surprised by that, because I just assumed that everyone would think Anthony, that's his moment of realization of, to be good, there's a point in this world, and we should be producing things, we should be, making efforts to connect people, and we should take responsibility for our actions. And I think if Anthony goes and writes this book, which would have been somehow a confession or taking responsibility, I assumed that was understood, and that just didn't happen. So I was pretty, pretty conscious. I mean, at the end of the book, I learned. I mean, that was what I learned in writing a novel. It was an endurance thing. It was a long, difficult process for me, and I think I learned a lot about myself and the world while trying to write this.
How long did it take you?
It was kind of on and off for about 8 years, 9 years.
Wow! And I assume there was a lot of revision at the end. Was that the bulk of the process, or was it?
there was most of the revision was cutting back. I cut off about 350 pages, and once it was taken, you know, there were some line edits, but not too much. We cut out one chapter, but most of it was just, you know, I've always had a full time job, and I write in the morning, so I don't get, you know, I just not fast.
Yeah. Well, with two little boys and a full time job, it can't.
Yeah.
The fact that you get up in the morning is hard enough, let alone writing a novel. That's tremendous. That's tremendous. Do you have any last-minute advice for people who are in your position? I had kind of wanted to touch on people who are writing and working full-time jobs, and perhaps you can offer some advice along those lines.
I think I say what everybody says, which is, you know, keep your butt in the chair. And I mean, learning how, for me, the two things, like, it wasn't literature classes that taught me how to actually write a novel. It was one, it was learning how to wake up at 4:30. It took me about a year before I could put away the alarm clock and I just get up now. And that was, I couldn't do it if I didn't wake up. And I don't think anybody can who writes, who has a full-time job or kids. But also, I started running marathons when I was around 30. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd never run other than to catch a bus prior to that. And the idea of running a mile seemed insane. And then you run one. And if you can run one, you can run three. And then if you can run three, you can run six. And then suddenly you're running 24 miles. And that was a really, I mean, it seems pretty straightforward, but that was a very big lesson for me to learn. And in terms of writing a book, you know, it's just about, you get to one page and then you get to the next. And then you get to the next, and suddenly you have 400 pages in front of you. And then you start beating, you know, then you cut it back, and then whatever, then you get through the whole revision. But learning that, you know, just sticking with something was hugely simple and straightforward. But for me, it took 30 years to learn.
That's great. That's a great analogy, too. That's wonderful. Michael, thanks for taking the time this morning.
No, thank you. I love your show, too.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That was Michael Fitzgerald, author of Radiant Days, available in bookstores now and published by Shoemaker and Horde. That's all the time we have for this morning. Before I go, as I always do, I'll leave you with a quote to mentally chew upon for the new year, when I know you're all making your resolutions, and hopefully they're mostly of mine are about writing, all the writing I hope to accomplish in the new year. It comes from Oscar Wilde, and it's simple advice. The man who will not execute his resolutions when they are fresh upon him can have no hope for them afterwards. They will be dissipated, lost, and perish in the hurry and scurry of the world, or sunk in the slough of indolence. I suppose that goes for women, too. Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be back with you next week, and we'll both be back with you the week following. So until then, have a great day and a happy new year. Take care.